Maine's 1st District Representative, Shelley Pingree, answers your questions about current issues before Congress. Representative Shelley Pingree has reason to celebrate this morning. A bill she's been working on for about 2 years passed unanimously last night in the U.S. House of Representatives. Its goal is to help protect the York River. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we'll ask Representative Pingree about that bill and about her other priorities during the current congressional session. What does she believe the U.S. role in the Ukrainian situation should be? Why is she advocating against the proposed Time Warner Comcast merger? How will the new farm bill affect Maine? And what is her stand on whether the federal minimum wage should be raised? We'll ask those questions and your questions, too. Maine Calling and Congresswoman Pingree take your calls. But first, this news update. From the MPBN studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. A nearly $4 trillion budget. A crisis in Ukraine, a proposed merger of two cable TV giants, and whether or not to raise the minimum wage. These are just a few of the issues currently facing the nation. Today on the program, Congresswoman Shelley Pingree will join us to talk about world affairs, domestic priorities, and matters important to us here in Maine. Pingree was first elected to Congress in 2008. She serves on the powerful House Appropriations Committee. She joins us from the House recording studio. Of course, we want to hear from you. What issues are first and foremost for you? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. Our email address is talk@mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Congresswoman Pingree is not in place yet. We're not quite sure what's going on. What we're hoping to do until Congresswoman Pingree arrives at the House recording studio is go to a couple calls and hear what you're thinking about. What are the issues most important to you? And we'll find a way to get that message to Congresswoman Pingree. And Larry and Caribou, I'm going to go to you first. What is the issue that is most important to you and would like to know from Congresswoman Pingree?
Well, thank you, first of all, for taking my call and for having the Congresswoman on. The issue that's most important to me, and I think to all people in the world, is what's going on in Ukraine with the brinksmanship and bringing the world close to possible nuclear war. Now, if people want to find out what's really going on with that situation, they need to go to the alternative media. They need to go to websites like globalresearch.ca or LaRouchePAC.com, because there you will get the unvarnished reporting on it.
What is different in the alternative media than what we're hearing in outlets such as the New York Times and on the national news?
Well, the New York Times has a history of being a mouthpiece.
Well, no, not about for the history. Today, in this issue, what is different? What are you hearing differently about the Ukrainian crisis?
Well, what's different is we're not hearing about the insertion of these neo-Nazi radicals being integrated into the newly formed government of the Ukraine, We're not hearing about that. We're not hearing about the positions that are being given in justice and education.
Okay. Well, Larry, I will be sure and ask Congresswoman Pingree about Ukraine and her perspective on the issue. Apparently, she's in the studio and just about to be wired up for our program. So thank you so much. Going now to Dick and Raymond. Dick, go ahead. You're on Maine Calling. Congresswoman Pingree will be hearing your question in just a moment.
Okay. Should I say what I want now? Or
yes, please.
Okay, thank you very much. I'm interested, first of all, on the possible blocking of the veterans' benefit program and their benefits, and they seem to be getting a second, not getting very good help from some of our senators, and I was wondering if the House of Representatives has taken this up yet. And I'd like to find out what the story is on it and why. And am I missing something? I don't think we're getting the whole story, and I'd like to know exactly how the veterans stand in future help from the government after they have fought in wars and have these come home with these diseases and so forth and so on.
Dick, I'm interested in what specifically, what parts of the what veterans' benefits are you finding or are you hearing that are not available that should be?
Well, they had a Senate. Now there's two schools of thought here. I called up Senator Collins's and the lady that answered said that it was going back to the vote itself was going to go back. It did not pass. Had 56 votes against 41 votes against. Completely, according to whatever you are, Democrat or Republican.
Dick, Congresswoman Pingree is now on the line, and Congresswoman Pingree, thank you so much for joining us on Maine Calling. Dick and Raymond is asking about veterans' benefits and what is going on in Congress today in regards to that. What can you bring to the conversation?
Well, I'm sorry, I just heard the second half of the question, but I did appreciate one of the things that he mentioned, which is, clearly when people serve their country, the one thing we want to make sure is that we are there to support them when they come home. I'm not exactly sure what he was referring to, although there was a cut that was made in the appropriations bill that would have affected future retirees. Frankly, for me, it was one of the reasons I opposed the bill. But it was followed up by after the appropriations bill was fully passed and went through both the House and the Senate, then there has been a bill circulating to rectify those cuts. So perhaps he's talking about that. I don't know exactly the status of that in the Senate, but I'd be happy to check on it and get back to him. But I will just say I certainly agree with the original premise of his concerns is that there are often proposed cuts in health care, in retirement benefits, and a variety of things that would affect our returning veterans. And I will say, particularly the young people and people of all ages who have returned from Iraq and Afghanistan, many of them are struggling with PTSD, with other kinds of very serious injuries. And the last thing we want to see happen is that they're not fully supported when they are making their return to Maine and other states or as they need care along the way. So I certainly understand his issues and am fully supportive.
Well, Dick, thanks so much for your call. Congresswoman Pingree, our first call was an issue that's very much on everybody's mind today, which, of course, are what's going on in the Ukraine. Can you tell us your perspective on what's going on and what you believe at this point the U.S. response should be, if anything?
Well, you're right. It's an issue on everyone's mind, and certainly a lot of concerns are being raised. And it's a situation that's literally changing hour to hour. My initial feeling was very pleased that the Secretary of State Kerry was over there and looking for any kind of diplomatic solution to this. And I think that most of the members of Congress are looking for what can we do diplomatically before anything happens to escalate this situation. I know the president has already slowed down any preparation for the G8, certainly said that we won't participate if Russia's participating. There's been talk about suspending their membership in it. We just got word that there may be a bill on the floor of the House tomorrow for economic aid, and I know that's, again, a thing that the president and Secretary Kerry have recommended, that there should be immediate aid to the Ukraine. The Russian government shut off some funding that they were depending on, and they're close to bankruptcy. So, we're talking about a variety of things, economic sanctions, freezing assets, slowing down visas. I think most of us feel that the first activity really should come from the EU. They're the biggest trading partners and have the most influence, but it's clearly a crazy upside down situation, and a lot of focus is on Putin and some of his current actions. And I think we're all hoping that there will be a way to defuse this situation, in a short period of time before anything really escalates. Okay. I guess I would also add, if there's one thing we know, America is very war weary, and Congress's response to issues like this is slightly different than it was in the early days of Afghanistan, of Iraq, and I think we are all trying to apply a little bit of caution to the situation.
Last night, a bill that you sponsored and have been fighting for a while passed. Tell us about what this will mean for the York River.
Well, thank you for that. And I think you might have heard from my office, even though I was slightly late this morning. Originally, after the snow and the schedule change, they were going to put it on at 12:30. And I had to go to floor leadership and say, I can't go on at 12:30. I got to be at MPBN.
Well, I'm glad you have your priorities straight.
Exactly. I mean, what will people say at home that, you know, I'm just, you know, on the floor? But luckily, we were able to, you know, make it just in time to move the bill yesterday, and I was very pleased that there was no opposition to it. And we're hoping that this bill will be able to move forward and go to the Senate. I've been working on this with a tremendous amount of support with communities around the York River. It's an important resource in southern Maine. This would create a study that would be done in conjunction with community input, and it would determine if the river would eventually be eligible for designation as a wild and scenic partnership river by the National Park Service. So this is a designation that would be eventually decided on by the National Park Service, but the study allows those communities in the York River area to really investigate what the impact would be, what the importance of it is, what kind of federal funding would be necessary to preserve the area, to restore fish and wildlife habitat. It's like I said, a wonderful resource. It's a very critical resource in southern Maine. There aren't that many watersheds and critical rivers down there. And this is an area that's used for fishing. There are farms alongside of it. It's recreational. It's important to communities in a whole variety of ways. And there's a lot of history there. So we're very excited that we were able to move this forward. And we're just hoping that there will be similar action in the Senate. And then they can actually receive the funds and start doing the study.
Great. We're going to take another call, going to David in Kanduskeg. Go ahead, David.
Hello, Congresswoman. I was actually calling to see your thoughts on timetable for achieving true energy independence here in the state and regionally, and not just energy independence, but sustainable energy independence, as I think myself that that's a key for economic success for current and future generations.
Thank you for that question. And it's a great question. It's certainly critical to the state of Maine. I was thinking about a timetable. You know, if I had my way, it would be a escalated timetable, and we would be working much harder on this than we currently are. In my first term in Congress, we passed an energy independence bill, and had really high hopes that we could get this country on the fast track to ending our dependence on foreign oil and a variety of other energy uses. I think it's critical not only because of our issues around global warming and some of the difficult situations we get into using fossil fuels, but also because in the state of Maine, it has the possibility of being, you know, great for our particular economy. Most jobs related to renewable energy are they're local jobs. They're good green jobs. They just have a lot of potential for us. Now, as you know, there's a lot of projects already going in Maine. Wind power, of course, has expanded quite a bit. There are tidal power projects. There's a pilot project that's going on in northern Maine. There's substantial federal investment in future offshore wind, some of the ideas that are being worked on by the University of Maine, and some initial studies will be done on the idea of offshore wind, which we have great potential in Maine because we have the combination of deep water and, as any Mainer knows, we have wind. So we could be at some point potentially a net energy producer if there's, you know, if there's a workable technology around that. But I'm also interested in some of the things that, you know, sort of happen more locally. I happen to live in one of the offshore island communities, North Haven and Vinyl Haven. We have three 1.5 megawatt towers that provide sort of the net amount of energy that those offshore islands use, and that's certainly been beneficial to getting us off dependence on the cable that connects us to the mainland just coming in one direction, but also has helped to reduce our energy costs, and I think some of those things could happen in other parts of the state. you know, more investment in solar energy. There are a lot of projects on some of the newer buildings. And then, of course, one of the things that's really important in Maine is energy conservation. I often say to people, we've got the double complication of being one of the most oil-dependent states, because until fairly recently, we didn't have a lot of other options of fuel. And we're also one of the states with some of the oldest housing stock. And so being able to invest some money in helping people retrofit their houses, getting tighter windows, more insulation, and using those standards on new buildings that are being constructed will make a big difference and has made some difference in our energy use. So I am a big supporter across the board, also in some of the production tax credits that make it possible for these investments to be somewhat more reasonable. And, you know, just hope that we can keep moving in that direction. There are always a lot of there's always a lot of counter pressure on the other side, particularly at the congressional level from some of the traditional fuel industries. And we always have to work to, you know, sort of continue to fight that this has to be a long-term goal to have renewable energy that's produced here in the United States and produced particularly in our home state.
All right. Well, David, thank you for your call. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, your comments and questions. Stay with us. This is Maine Calling.
Broadcast of Maine Calling is made possible by MPBN listeners and by Revision Energy, a local business specializing in the design, installation, and service of solar energy systems, revisionenergy.com, and by Baxter Brewing Company in Lewiston, committed to 100% wind-powered beer production, baxterbrewing.com.
The caricatures of Tammany Hall's Boss Tweed in 19th century political cartoons became a symbol of corrupt machine politics. On The Next Fresh Air, historian Terry Galway offers a different take. He says Tammany Hall provided struggling immigrants with needed social services and got legislation enacted that foreshadowed the New Deal. Galway's new book is called Machine Made. Join us.
Join us for Fresh Air this evening at 7 o'clock. Are you ready for another television season of a cantankerous doctor, an unlikely love affair, and some truly quirky characters running about in a small coastal village somewhere over the pond? If yes, then you don't want to miss out on this. Join MPBN and The Grand to see the Season 6 premiere episode of Doc Martin before it's broadcast on MPBN television across Maine. Go to MPBN.net and register for your free tickets. Click on the Doc Martin banner or click on the events link. The premiere will be held at the Grand in Ellsworth, Maine, tomorrow, Thursday evening, 7 o'clock. Doors open at 6:15. We hope to see you there.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, Maine's 1st Congressional District Representative, Shelley Pingree, joins us from Washington. We invite you to join our conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Email talk at mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. I know, Congresswoman Pingree, one of the initiatives you've taken recently is in opposition to the proposed Time Warner Comcast merger, and that you're involved in a petition drive. What can you, as a congresswoman, what can Congress do? Does Congress have any say in this merger?
Well, that's always a good question. Does Congress really have any power to do much of anything anyway? And of course we do. We were a little concerned when we first heard about this. I think people always have a lot of issues with their cable providers, some of the bundling that's gone on, the costs that have been increasing, and the idea of putting two of the largest companies in the country together raised a lot of questions about whether there will be enough competition to help keep down costs, whether prices are likely to go up. And then a lot of the other issues that people frequently bring up about net neutrality. How do we make sure that what comes through, that it's sort of treated equally, that certain things coming over the internet don't have higher priority over others? And that's there's a lot of questions raised about this if there was so much power concentrated in one place. So this merger has to be approved by both the FCC and the Justice Department. And the FCC has to determine whether it's in the public interest. The Justice Department has to determine whether it violates antitrust laws. And so we have participated in a petition just letting people know that there are a lot of concerns out there. We're also sending a letter to the Attorney General Holder, and the chair of the FCC. So we're trying to dig in a little bit on our concerns, commenting to them directly. And they do take public comment into consideration. They certainly take comments into consideration that come from members of Congress, because we attempt our as best we can to represent the concerns that we're hearing from our constituents. I will say that because of the recent decision around net neutrality, that exacerbated some of people's worries about this idea that the internet should be free and open and there shouldn't be discrimination on certain kinds of information. And that's an issue I've been concerned about for a long time. I've signed on to bills in Congress that have recently come up after the decision to go back to that question again. So I think that makes this even more of a critical issue right now.
All right. We have so many emails coming in and phone calls as well. I'll try to get through as many as possible. This is from Susan in Freiburg. She writes in an email, "I'm wondering if there's any hope for unemployment extension for the so-called long-term unemployed. My daughter-in-law was one of those who lost her unemployment. She'd only been on it since May, so not that long-term. And it's been a real hardship. She and my son have a one-year-old baby. They don't have time to figure out how to pay their bills without her check coming in. 2 months behind an electric, someone bashed in the passenger side window of their car, and they don't have the money to fix it. She says, I've sent them money for food, but I don't have much myself. I think what's happening in D.C. over this and many other issues is unconscionable, and I don't even hear it on the news anymore. These people are simply forgotten, and it is so wrong." That's Susan in Freiburg.
Well, Susan, thank you for your comments, and I'm very sorry to hear about the challenges that your family is going through, and I'm sorry to also say that there are many people struggling in Maine with the same issues. There's over 6,700 people in Maine who have lost their unemployment benefits, 2 million people nationally. I have opposed this at every step of the way, and I will say that many of my colleagues have been trying to insert an extension of unemployment insurance everywhere we possibly can. The current majority in the House, the Republican Party, is completely uninterested in taking this up. And it's just a very frustrating issue. I think, you know, some people are trying to argue that this economy is somewhat better, so there's plenty of jobs out there. If there's one thing that we know in Maine, there just aren't enough jobs to go around. Often in the winter, it's the most challenging time for people to find work. They struggle to get through the winter. And you take a year like this one where we've had, you know, such extreme cold weather, people's oil bills are higher than they've ever been. There are just so many challenges that people are facing, and we're seeing it in a variety of ways. So I wish I could give you a simple answer or promise you that my colleagues are going to change this in the next week, and I am doing everything I can to do it. I would also say it's foolhardy logic in many ways, because not only do we help people struggling who end up, you know, turning to their families who are struggling, going to the food bank, doing whatever they can to keep things going, maybe losing their home or having other difficulties. But unemployment checks, when they come into Maine, go right back into the community. People don't save those. They don't hide them under their bed. They don't put them in their bank account. They spend them right away. So it goes to the local grocery stores. It pays off their bills. It you know, helps support their kids going to school. I mean, it's just such a critically important thing. So all I can say at this point is I agree with you, and I'm really sorry that I can't push my colleagues to find an easier fix, but I hope that we will rectify this.
All right. Well, thank you. Going to Kathy in Waldo. Hi, Kathy. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hello. This, you know, your first caller said something about the lack of other resources on the issue of Ukraine. And I've just been looking on my internet, and it certainly seems to be true. You know, the right-wing people in Ukraine, I'm seeing a YouTube where they come into the council meeting in black masks, and they're carrying hammers and baseball bats and other things, and they tell the Regions Party, which was Yanukovych's party, that they have to leave. They suggest that they leave. Of course, they're brandishing these weapons, not guns, but something to beat you over the head with. And we don't, we're not hearing about that. We're not hearing an analysis of who these right-wing people are, how many of them are now sitting in the rump parliament.
Kathy, do you have a question for Congresswoman Pingree?
I want to know whether Representative Pingree is going to support sending $1 billion of U.S. taxpayers' money to a illegal government in Ukraine, because the legally elected president sent a letter to the Russians asking them to come in and protect people from these people who did a coup.
Okay, so I understand your question, Congresswoman Pingree.
Well, thank you very much for your question, and I think this points up what a complex issue this is. Obviously, there is a lot of concern about what went on, whether the elected president of this country turned on his own people, whether the Russians are behaving appropriately here, what's behind the scenes. You saw Putin say that maybe that he didn't even agree with the idea that the Russian troops that were in there were Russian and that maybe they had gotten their uniforms in some other way. So it's very hard to separate the information from the misinformation. And I think that's one of the critical things that's happening right now, either in how Congress is being informed, how the American public is being informed, and making sure that, for instance, if we have tomorrow or early next week, any kind of an aid package that's on the floor for the Ukraine, you know, will the dollars be contingent on reform? What is the story to the best of our knowledge that goes behind the scenes? Again, this is a very complex issue. And I would say, you know, first thing is before the United States does anything to heighten or escalate the challenges, we want to make sure they're extremely well formed. So I appreciate your thoughts on that.
All right. Well, thank you, Kathy. Going to an email now. This is from Brian in Harpswell, Maine. Dear Representative Pingree, Maine still suffers from the drastic cuts in education funding that accompanied the economic downturn that began 6 years ago. In the district where I work, before the cuts, high school students had about 40 electives from which to choose to fulfill graduation requirements and acquire knowledge in areas of interest. Today, there are less than half that number, and they are concentrated in art and music. When is the federal government going to help restore funding so the public schools can be adequately funded?
Excellent question. And I wholeheartedly support your concerns. I go back to some of my early days as being engaged in public service, and one of my early opportunities was to serve on my local school board, and also, you know, to help work through local budgets. And in the many years I've been involved since then, funding for education has always been one of the big concerns, whether it's through the legislature or how federal funding works. And I think that we know in Maine, where we're constantly struggling to raise the opportunities for our kids, make more kids eligible to go on to higher education, to improve wages. We know that getting a good education is one of the most critical things that we can do. The president released his budget yesterday, and he does have increased funding for education. So we will be doing everything we can to try to support the initiatives that are in the president's budget. We've been operating under a lot of budget constraints over the last couple of years, and the budget sequester, the cutback funding at all levels. So Maine has suffered from some of those cuts and the federal dollars that don't go down. And I wholeheartedly support the concerns of this caller or emailer that really Maine could benefit from a lot more funding. And there are many areas that I hear about constantly. For instance, special education funding, which is never, we've never met the federal mandate on that. And there are a lot of ways that the federal government funding at appropriate level could take some of the burden off local school departments and state level funding. And it's just unthinkable that we don't do that.
From our Facebook page, Congresswoman Pingree, this is a question from Kathleen. She writes, I'm gravely concerned by the growing monopolization of our seed and organic industry. The food goliaths are swallowing up the smaller companies, and I'm concerned that they will be able to redefine organic. manipulate labeling more than they already do, and we will have no alternatives. The fact that some of the major players are also chemical companies is very scary. Seeds designed to sell pesticides and herbicides are responsible for major pollution of the water, land, and our bodies. I did not see a single monarch butterfly last year. So here's the question. Why is this type of conglomerate not treated as a monopoly? We are concerned about Comcast, Time Warner. Why not about the takeover of our food supply? I know you're very involved in food supply issues.
Well, thank you for that question. And I'm always impressed at how many constituents communicate with me about some of these issues, whether it's the appropriate labeling of GMOs or concerns about monopolies around seeds and the difficulties of farmers who want to save their own seed or have opportunities, whether it's some of the drift of, GMO crops and organic farmers who are in the same area. And I really appreciate you bringing up the monarch butterfly, because that is one of the examples that I frequently use for people, not to get carried away. But in 1996, there were a billion monarch butterflies who traveled from northern states like Maine down to a little valley in Mexico. And if you fast forward to 2013, it was down to 30 million. So it's not surprised that one of those things that we take for granted, the return of the butterfly, severely changed, and particularly changed in the last few years. Many of us attribute that, and I think many scientists believe that that is related to the increased use of Roundup, an herbicide that's commonly applied to a variety of crops, and that is applied to the fields where some of the GMO Roundup resistant crops are grown. So you've got a lot of farmers who, particularly in the Midwest, we don't see much of this in Maine, but who use the Roundup resistant GMO seeds. And because a lot of the food that the butterfly depend on, particularly milkweed, has really disappeared because of the extreme use of Roundup. So that's kind of a convoluted way to get around to this issue that more and more examples are coming up and more dramatic change year by year. So I am a strong supporter of GMO labeling. I am deeply concerned about the increased use of herbicides because of GMO resistant seeds. And serving first on the Agriculture Committee and now the Agriculture Appropriations Committee, we use every opportunity we can to support legislation that would look at this more closely, that would put in language to appropriations bills anywhere we can. But as the caller, I think, rightfully suggests, is that some of the companies we're dealing with are massive. They have a lot of influence in Washington and over our agricultural policy, and we consider it an important fight every day. And I think she raises a really important concern for a variety of reasons.
Okay, we're going to take another short break. When we return, more of your comments and questions. Please stay with us.
Broadcast and Maine Calling is made possible by MPBN listeners and by TechPort, offering iPad and MacBook service in downtown Portland, Mac certified and locally owned. Learn more at techportmaine.com. And by CEI, presenting Steve Curwood speaking about climate change and economic opportunity on March 11th. Learn more at ceimaine.org.
I'm Barbara Bogave. Next time on America Abroad, the revolutions of the Arab Spring promised greater freedoms for the people of the Middle East. And while some freedoms have been gained, in many cases, stability has been lost. It's become more dangerous, especially for women.
Today, there are women's suicides, honor killings, child marriages.
Women's rights after the Arab Spring. That's next time on America Abroad from Public Radio International.
America Abroad, following Maine Calling at 1 o'clock here on MPBN. For those of you who regularly watch MPBN television, we probably don't have to tell you that our important March membership campaign is underway, the time that MPBN sets aside each year to raise support from viewers to keep this important public service and quality programming going in the year ahead. Unlike our Super Thursday campaigns here on radio, the television campaign is 2 weeks long. However, we've heard from many of you, and we're doing something a bit different this time around. While we have many special programs in our schedule, we're also including many of your favorite regular programs from the NewsHour, American Experience, Nature, Nova, many more. Fund your favorites. We hope you appreciate this adjustment, this experiment, and support both your public television station and this new way of keeping many regular programs in our schedule during our vital membership campaign. Thank you for your support of public broadcasting here in Maine.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, the latest news out of Washington, and on the line from the House Recording Studio, Congresswoman Shelley Pingree. We invite you to join the conversation. Give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. I want to state right out that we will not be able to get to most of the emails and calls that are coming in. This show has been very popular. We're trying our best, but just don't want anybody to be offended and believe they had been singled out. Going now to Janet in Powinell. Hi, Janet. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you very much for taking my call. First off, Representative Pingree, I really want to thank you for your fantastic record on environmental issues. Today, specifically, I'm calling with an urgent request as well as a question about policy. The urgent request is to ask you to please sign Representative Peter DeFazio's letter, which urges Interior Secretary Jewell to require Fish and Wildlife Service to rescind its proposal to delist from the endangered species list most gray wolves from the lower 48. And on a broader level, I would just like to ask what your thoughts are for reform regarding treatment of both wolves and also wild horses and other endemic species on the nation's public lands in the western United States. It seems to me, and I'll, obviously it's a question, but it just seems to me that a small minority of well-heeled ranching interests has pretty much hijacked many of these agencies, specifically the Bureau of Land Management and Fish and Wildlife Services, and they are getting these agencies to rid our nation's public lands of any species that they consider to compete with the livestock that they get a very generous subsidy.
Okay, Janet, I'm going to let Congresswoman Pingree respond. Go ahead.
Well, thank you for your question, and thank you for your nice comments on that. And I think you're right on the fact that there's often a big division between how some states feel about this and sort of Western interests and some of the bigger farms where they have a variety of different concerns. We did sign onto a letter last year on the issue around protecting wolves, and I will certainly look into Congressman DeFazio's letter just to make sure that if it's something that seems like it would be beneficial, we will get involved. He's done a lot of great work on this issue, and you're right. I mean, I know there are a lot of concerns about areas with wild horses, and I think the last thing, you know, that we want to have happen is commercial farming taking up so much space, particularly in the Midwest and Western states where it's, you know, a much higher proportion of area, that we lose a lot of our wild and natural species, whether it's plants or animals, and, you know, just a huge amount of concerns that people have. So anyway, I thank you very much for your question and your nice comments. I will look into that letter right away. And I know we did sign on to that letter last year or a similar letter.
Thank you, Janet. Going to Kelly in Falmouth. Hi, Kelly.
Hey, thanks for taking my call, ladies. I run a social enterprise in Falmouth, and I think that the best corporate designation for me would be a B Corp, a for-benefit corporation, but they aren't recognized in Maine, so I'm wondering if there is any chance that they might be.
Wow, good question. I have no idea, but I will definitely look into it. And if you either want to call our office and let them know that you'd like more information on this so we can connect with you offline, we will definitely do that. And honestly, I have to say I don't know that much about this particular corporate designation, but I know there are a variety of ways that people are designated. And if it's something that would be important or useful in Maine, we'd be happy to look into it.
All right. Thank you, Kelly. Going to James in Bangor. Hi, James. Go ahead.
Hi. How are you?
I'm great.
My question is one that concerns me from being a little bit older in the population, but not that much older. I watched as a young kid friends of mine's father who had normal fathers, had normal jobs, like they were the grocery store manager, the, you know, the that type of job where it's upper scale. When you walk into a grocery store nowadays in Maine, you see nothing but college kids or younger for the most part working there. And so the minimum wage of $10 an hour might help them to bring them up to $400 a week. But if you take an apartment rental in Bangor, the average apartment is $800, cell phone bill is $100, heat, so on and so forth, that $1,200 a month, how is that going to help us? What I wanted to find out is what Congress and the people in D.C. were doing to actually change the focus on just the startup jobs, but the middle jobs, the jobs where we can actually make a living and survive. I don't know what my kids are going to do. I'm fine to the end of my life, but I have no idea what the kids are going to do in the future as far as moving in, because it doesn't seem like any company ever is expanding the job market other than the startup work.
Congresswoman Pingree, how do we expand what is known as the middle class?
Yeah, and it's an excellent question. I mean, I think if there's one thing that people are increasingly worried about in this country, it's the shrinking size of the middle class. It's the lowering of wages. And it's a lot of challenges that people face who want to make sure that, kind of as the caller said, you want to make sure that your children have a better opportunity than you do. And increasingly, we're finding generations don't have those same opportunities. I think it requires a variety of solutions. First, I will say I wholeheartedly support an increase in the minimum wage, and I agree with the caller. That's not a panacea to end everything, but the current minimum wage is, at a federal level, is $7.25 an hour. It's $7.50 in Maine. That means a worker making a minimum wage makes about $15,000. That is not enough to make all the payments that people have in life, as you suggested, whether it's your rent, having a car to get to work, putting food on the table, supporting your kids. There's just so many issues that people have to deal with. But if we were able to raise it at least to the current suggestion of $10.10 an hour, index it to inflation like it is in many states, it would keep going up as costs keep going up. I read an interesting study, and I'm just talking about the minimum wage now, but we often forget that the hidden costs of having such low wages mean that we are subsidizing many of the bigger employers, particularly national chains, who pay these lower wages, whether we're subsidizing people through qualifying for Medicaid, healthcare assistance. And I was saying, I read a study this morning that said if we raise the minimum wage to $10.10 an hour, it would reduce the overall food stamp, called SNAP, expenditures by $4.6 billion a year. I mean, that's more than the Republicans proposed to cut it this year. So that's a pretty significant amount, and a very graphic way to understand that low wages often mean that taxpayers have to subsidize those companies who pay their workers a low wage. Back to the kind of question about how to increase opportunities for the middle class. I mean, one of the issues that I think is really critical, and the president does have in his current budget that just came out this week, is ways to make college more affordable. That is always a big issue in Maine. We have one of the highest rates of young people graduating from high school, one of the lowest rates of young people going on to college. Getting a college degree or a two-year degree is the fastest way to raise your potential wage in the future. Yet many young people and their families are burdened by the idea that college will be so expensive, worried that they won't get a job that adequately helps them pay back their loans. And so often people just don't make that choice. I also think that there are a lot of good industries that have the potential in Maine. We talked about clean energy jobs. Many of those jobs create opportunities that are likely to have higher paying wages. One of the emphasis that the president has and people have been concerned about for a while is STEM education, increasing opportunities in math and science, getting more young women in careers in math and science. Those are often, whether it's engineering or other kinds of research work, those opportunities often go unfilled in Maine. I hear often from companies that say they have to find employees from out of state because we don't have enough people currently educated or residential in Maine who can take those jobs. So right there, that's a great opportunity. But again, it involves the cost of going to college. It involves a great education and a well-funded education all the way up K through 12 so that students are adequately prepared and interested and know those opportunities are out there. So many of the things that the callers have mentioned earlier today, a few changes along the way could have a significant impact in enhancing the opportunities for the next generation to be comfortably in the middle class and above.
James, thanks for your call. An email from Ellen doesn't say where she lives. Dear Senator, she says, "Dear Senator Pingree," I'll change that to Representative Pingree. "Thank you for all you do for Maine citizens and the environment. The federal heating assistance program seems to predominantly give Maine citizens limited access for purchasing fuel. Is there any move towards turning this funding more towards heavily insulating homes of low-income families or installing alternative technology so that less fuel is necessary each year? That seems to be make more sense to reduce fossil fuel use as well to reduce global warming." Ellen.
Yeah, great question. And, you know, that's commonly known as LIHEAP, which is the funding that comes to states like Maine. And generally, we struggle to get adequate funding for that every year. It's an issue that's always pushed by our entire delegation, the House and the Senate. And we have also been strong supporters of pushing weatherization money as a part of that. So it is possible to use that money for weatherization. And the caller is absolutely right that if you can invest in making those changes to a person's home, we talked about it earlier, the insulation, the better windows, sometimes it's sealing off a basement. And there's a lot of great people working in that field in Maine today that can come in and do an energy audit, that can actually see where the leaks in the house are. There's some money available to providing assistance to people whose homes need that assistance. There's some money out there. And I would say, again, not only does it save on overall heating costs, it reduces our dependence on foreign oil. It makes it possible for the resident of that home to have lower heating bills in future years so they're not so dependent on an annual subsidy. But also, those are great green energy jobs. The people who do the energy audits that come in and do the weatherization of homes, it's a good opportunity for people. And it's a wonderful thing that people can do in our state as another employment opportunity.
Another email, this from Linda in Wells. "Environmentalists around the country are urging President Obama to say no to the proposed Keystone Pipeline. Tar sands extraction in Alberta is an environmental and humanitarian disaster. We don't want any more disastrous spills of this oil mixed with sand and chemicals. Environmentalists in Maine are opposed to," she says, "the proposed reversal of PPL that would carry tar sands through Maine. Representative Pingree, please state your position." And I will correct her email a little bit by saying there, as far as I know, there actually is no proposal at this point. Go ahead.
No, I've been opposed to the Keystone Pipeline. I've asked the State Department to review any potential reversal, as she mentions. And again, I have great concerns about this. There's a lot of information out there that shows that some of the extraction of this substance that would come through the Keystone Pipeline is going to have a bad environmental effect. And a lot of the literature and information out there says that most of the product that would be carried in the Keystone Pipeline would actually be used for export. So while there is the possibility that there would be construction jobs along the way, and I know many people are in favor of it because of the construction jobs, that would be also a short-term benefit just to the states where the construction happened. And in the long run, given the enormous concerns we have about climate change and carbon production in this country, and the very idea that this is an exported fuel for the most part and probably would do very little, most likely would do almost nothing to lower energy costs here in this country, it's very hard to see good reasons to support it.
And we just have a little bit of time. I'll go to a brief email from Sue in Bridgeton. She asks, "Please explain what is going to happen to SNAP because of the farm bill that cuts so much funding. How will each person be affected?"
That was a very discouraging negotiation that's been going on in Congress for the last couple of years. The farm bill is reauthorized every 5 years. That stretched it into at least a 6-year period to get to reauthorization, and it was recently passed. the original Senate bill, I give a lot of credit to the Senate that while a lot of people suggested that there should be cuts to the SNAP program, the Senate settled on a $4 billion cut. When it came to the House, some of the more conservative members of the House kind of took control of that vote, and the House proposed a $44 billion cut, so 10 times as much. The final farm bill had an $8 billion cut, but that still has a substantial impact on states like Maine. People are struggling. It's about $120 a month that people receive to help feed their families. And I would say in a cold winter like this and a tough time economically, that's a lot to ask of people to sustain even more cuts. So I was opposed to those all along. I don't understand why a wealthy nation like ours would want anyone to go hungry, particularly children and the elderly. And I hope that we can do whatever we can to restore those cuts as time goes on.
Well, Congresswoman Pingree, thank you so much for joining us today. Shelley Pingree represents Maine's 1st Congressional District. Today's program was produced by Jonathan Smith. John Keimel ran the board, and we had help from the MPBN web team. You can find past editions of Maine Calling, as well as a link to our podcast, by visiting mpbn.net/MaineCalling. You can also find our podcast on iTunes. Tomorrow on the program, join host Keith Shortall for a conversation about what we know and are learning about detecting and treating blood clots. They are a leading cause of death in hospitals and the number one reason for costly hospital readmissions. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on the Maine Public Broadcasting Network.